not surprised.
I'm good, but I feel like I have to swear that. All right, this is policy meeting, August 5th, 2024. Jen is not going to be with us this evening as policy chair. So if y'all are okay with it, I'll go ahead and get us started. We've got first the board policies for first and final reading. Those recommending going ahead and approving those at the board meeting because it is legal changes. We'll walk through all those. And then two policies for first reading. They are, one policy is required by state law, and then the other are some changes through the state board, but you not just some compliance issues. So the first one.
Dana, do you mind if I interrupt? Would Melissa being new, I just wanted to mention, we traditionally and in policy have two readings for all our policies, unless it's to comply with a change in the law or a
editorial
change. Okay. So when Dana mentions first reading, it's going to be one of those two.
Okay. It's pretty normal for that to be our August meeting because of all the new laws.
Okay.
And waiting for them to be chaptered. So the first one is 1.501. So you'll notice there's a name change. Code of conduct for visitors to the schools and electronic and verbal communication to employees. So the blue pieces that are new is the visitor conduct. There are some new places per state law where now it needs to be on our website, providing copies, electronic copies, posted at our school entrance, along with a phone number where if someone has a question about the code of conduct, they can contact an administrator. And then consequences for code of conduct violations. The language in 2-6 has been there, but included the visitor conduct and the consequences heading just to make it a little bit more user-friendly when we were going through it. The pieces on page 1, the code of conduct 1-5, are what's specifically in statute. And that's been our policy. Mm-hmm. Already, yes, we're not adding to that. So the pieces in blue are our recommended changes based on new public chapter.
So quick FYI for y'all, it says we shall post it at the schools, and so we're doing clings where it can just show up on the window with those five, and they should already be at the
clings are not yet.
After the policy is approved, they will be eligible.
Yeah, right now there's paper posted because we needed to post it for the law, but once y'all have approved, we'll have clings on the way.
Upgrade a little bit.
Yes, while the paper's pretty.
All
that. We didn't want to order those until board approval. Any questions on that one? Okay. Next one is school calendar. So update in the law, public chapter 573, and that is our school closures for presidential primary election and or a regular November general election. I am not mistaken. Okay. She stepped out. If I'm not mistaken, it's already on this year's calendar.
That's right.
And then this will be moving forward on all of our other calendars.
So we're doing that, but now it's in law.
Now it's in law. Mm-hmm. Correct.
Last year, we did have a county primary during school. I will tell you, chances are, the next time that happens, I'm going to recommend to you all that we don't do that either.
I agree.
Because we have so many schools that are being used. Right.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So there'll be adults on campus. Okay. It's a PD day this year.
But the children will not be
there. Yeah, that's good. This is probably ticky-tack, but I think when you refer to president as the United States president, it's capitalized. But you might look that up.
I'll double check that. The next one is property sales. And this is any surplus property. We had an auction last month, I believe, and we already have updated our process to comply with the new state law. Notice shall be published on a news and information website in accordance with state law. There's some provisions set out in the law defining what that looks like. We will continue to also publish in the paper. So it will be the paper, it will also be on our website, WCS website, and then a news and information website as well.
Out of curiosity, how will you select the website that's chosen for that, the news and information website?
We chose the Williamson Herald because it had to be a paper with a open location to the public in the county, and that is it.
Right.
So
you'll use their website as well.
Correct. We already published there, but we're using their website, and then we've always published in WCS. But that's how we ended up picking the Herald.
What is the status of the property behind Creekside? Does anybody know? There's a bunch of property.
There's been no change. We bought that as part of the farm, as a condition of it. We've had some brief discussions with county government. Parks and Rec has said long term they may be interested in it, but that would take funding from the county to actually put a new facility there. So right now we're just holding it. As you know, we did build the outdoor classroom on the other side of the creek. But there's still many acres past that.
Right.
I actually drove by there last Sunday just to see the progress of that. I don't know if you've seen it recently.
Yeah, I drove by because it's my district. I live in that area, and it looks pretty good, but I don't think it's final.
It's not quite done.
Yes, there's some finishing touches or something.
And they need to grass it, too. It's got, dirt around it. But we don't have any plans right now. We're holding it.
Roughly how many acres?
I'm trying to remember off the top of my head. I'm going to estimate and probably be wrong, but I'm going to estimate 15 acres.
Yeah.
I'll double check on that. A lot of it has surface rock as well, and so you can drive back there anytime you want. It connects to the backside. We don't have. Well, let me think. Just a little bit extra information. One of the neighbors is selling as well right now, and so we don't have any known development, but there is the potential for that.
Well, it's a building site, and it's worth money.
The what?
It's worth money. It's a building site.
Yeah.
Whether it's got rock on it or not.
A residential developer. Do the math and figure out what to charge.
Hey, while we're on the subject of property, has anybody said anything about property being donated out at June Lake?
We have talked to the city of Spring Hill about that. They have said that long term they will tell the developer that they still want that. So generally speaking, what we've been told is they are still holding a space for that. And as you know, I mean, it's set to boom.
It's moving.
Yeah.
It's moving. There's houses are going up so fast.
Yeah.
I don't know how many apartment complexes.
Yeah. I haven't heard anything recently, so I'll get Brian to follow up.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Next one is the emergency preparedness plan. And that is on the first page. The new legislation that we work with law enforcement, with the fire department to develop a procedure for identifying the cause of a fire alarm activation. And then we have that, must have that procedure in place by January 1st of 2025. And then it's got to be reviewed and updated annually. Fletch and his team have already started that process of developing a procedure so that there's some, and I think I will remind everybody with the Safety and Security Act, we don't share what that procedure looks like, but just know that that is already happening. So that is that piece that has updated. Oh, the other thing I was going to show y'all, so if you go to the next page with legal references, all of them are in blue, and they are all hyperlinks now.
Oh.
So one of the things that we are doing when we're updating the policy is you can click on that, and it's going to take you to either the TCA, the public chapter, the state board rule, any of that. So I hope that will help staff, will help y'all, and it'll be a process updating them whenever we update the policy. So they're not all done, but that's why you see so many in blue, and they're going to be in blue every time.
And Dana, I think that's a TSDA feature, isn't it? Or that they...
It is, but we have to provide it.
Oh, interesting.
But yes. So the next one is security. We have had, for the last couple of years, certain instances of illegal entry, different things, building damage, theft, vandalism, that the principal had to report to law enforcement. One of those changes, and we changed call, but they've also got to report now to the superintendent of schools. And there's some additional pieces that have been updated. Assault and battery with a serious personal injury or involving a weapon, endangering life, health, or safety, or valid threats of mass violence, which we will talk about that with our zero tolerance because that law has been updated. So this just updates for our principals. Need to make sure that law enforcement and superintendent of schools knows about those instances if they occur.
Do we have... Like, because now we switch from call to report to. Do we have, like, what manners can be reported? Like, I mean, like, is it just going to be a phone call or is it going to be an email or, I mean, what?
Email.
Okay.
Yeah, it could be if the SRO is on the property, it may be the report or so a phone call or just, here's the SRO, let me tell you what's happening.
Okay.
But the system... typically to inform, and that's why we changed it from call.
Some way to inform.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, this is the new law change. The reality is I would get reports from Fletch anyway. If it was
right.
If it was something that needed immediate attention, usually he would call. If it's something that just was for my information, he would include an email. And I think he includes HR in that too, I think, related to threats.
Family life curriculum is the family life education is the next one. So a couple of different pieces because we've got three different public chapters that have been updated. The first one, and you'll probably saw this on the news, was that we have to have a presentation of a high-quality computer-generated animation or high-definition ultrasound, at least 3 minutes in duration, that shows the development of the brain, heart, and other vital organs in early fetal development. Dave and his team have identified, the law changed kind of as the session went on, so it's not one specific video, but it is a video that meets these definitions. So Dave and his team have identified the video that we're going to be using here. Also, we will not be showing that because one of the additional law changes, we wouldn't be showing that in grades K through 5. Instructions and topics related to sexual activity are not age appropriate for those students and shall not be taught. It would not, and you can read that, not have anything to do with teaching children about child sexual abuse or human trafficking. And then the last update is a new reporting update. At the beginning of each school year, superintendent has to provide the contact information to the Department of Children's Services for each employee who provides instruction on family life or curriculum related to child sex abuse, human trafficking, and internet crimes. So an additional reporting piece that DCS will be tracking.
So we already have our list of all our staff members.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now we got to figure out who to receive it. It says
yeah,
DCS,
we're not sure.
So we're not sure.
We're not sure where to send it yet, but
we're working on that.
The next one is report cards and grading systems. So change in weighted grades. Honors courses, pre-AP, and that would be including middle school courses taught at high school, honors level, those will receive an additional 3 percentage points. To the grades used to calculate semester average, local and statewide, dual credit, capstone, shall include 4 percentage points, and then AP, CLEP, IB, dual enrollment courses, Cambridge International will be an addition of 5 percentage points. And then we have the methodology that's used to calculate those, and I think we've talked about this before, that we will include that in the high school programming guide so that a school, university, college, when they are seeing a transcript, will see how it has changed, and I think that benefits our students to continue that practice. So all of the changes in the weighted grades are changes that are required under the State Board of Education regulations.
Quick FYI, we don't actually have a Cambridge International program, but it's possible the student may come to us.
To us.
Who does?
Do we see any unintended consequences of this popping up at all?
Lee?
No, the major shift here is with dual enrollment, shifting from 4 added points to 5. We've kept a pretty healthy number of students who elect to take dual enrollment versus AP, and those are truly individual conversations with the school counselor of what's in the best interest of that individual child. So at this point, I don't have any concerns.
It might theoretically put a little bit of an additional premium on dual enrollment courses,
sure.
Right? Just because it's just 1 percentage point. It should not be huge.
So promotion and retention, we've got 2 different public chapters. The first one, I don't know that it got as much press, but at the bottom you're going to see voluntary retention. So if there is a parent or guardian of a student enrolled in kindergarten through second grade, that parent or guardian can retain the student in the current grade level if the student has a documented academic or behavior delay, and the parent or guardian believes that retention may benefit the student. So that's why we're calling it voluntary. It is a parent choice. With that documentation, not a school choice for retention.
So in the past, the parents never had a choice to keep their kids back?
They did in consultation with administration.
Okay.
So
and go ahead. I was going to say administration.
Yeah.
Kind of changed over the years, but it was definitely not just parents with no input.
It was the principal's decision in consultation with the parents. So this shifts the final decision maker from the principal to the parent for K-2.
So in the past, now I'm talking old school.
Yeah.
In the past, you know, if the parent didn't think their child was developmentally ready, and you know, when they obviously were very close to that child, they would just say, "I'm just going to hold it back to kindergarten." But that wasn't the case in the past. It had to be a principal that actually recommends it. So now it's back to the parent.
That's right.
If they have the proper documentation.
Yeah, and I don't know how many years, but I'm estimating at least 15 years or so, the parent, once they enrolled them in kindergarten, were subject to the principal's decision, but they could hold them back until they turned age 6
mm-hmm.
prior to enrollment.
Oh, okay. Okay.
But now they can still make that decision, K-1 and 2.
But the schools didn't generally recommend that.
Yeah, you're right. It's rare.
That's right. It was rare.
Yeah. Okay. It was.
What's an example of a documented academic or behavioral delay?
That's a great question that is not defined anywhere. And given the fact that it's the parents voluntarily deciding to retain, I'm going to say it's going to be pretty broad.
There are some that are obvious. An IEP that had some behavioral plans in it. Those are easy, but to Dana's point, it could be something even simpler than that.
Something from a physician, perhaps.
Could be right. ADHD. It could be any number of things. And it also doesn't say who has to provide the documentation, other than the parent. Could be a physician. Could be a therapist. All of that is not defined.
Okay, so they don't necessarily need an IEP in order to be retained.
Correct.
Correct.
That's right.
Parent's choice.
The IEP would be a smaller circle in the Venn diagram, right? It could be more things other than the IEP.
Yep. So that's part one of the change. Then we go to a little bit on page 4 and 5. This is definitely what got more media attention, and I think what we tried to update you on as things were changing. So the updated law on the third grade retention, the first one is we changed some language, so it's on track or mastered. That's just to be consistent. Then the meat of what is changing starts on page 4. There's your demonstrated proficiency, scoring in the 50th percentile. That's one of your approaching expectations. Then the bigger piece, or piece we didn't have as much information on, was the decision of retention for fourth grade. So it gives students in categories an avenue to be promoted to fifth grade if they demonstrate adequate growth on the fourth grade ELA portion of TCAP. If a student was promoted to fourth grade under one of those two provisions above, and they do not demonstrate adequate growth on the ELA portion of the TCAP, then there's a conference that happens between the principal, the parent or guardian, the ELA teacher. That conference, they review the ELA performance to determine if the student should be promoted to fifth grade. And if the majority of the parties agree, then that student is promoted to fifth grade. There's a tutor for the fifth grade year assigned to the student. If they're retained, if the majority of the parties agree that the child should be retained, then they could not be retained more than once in fourth grade. So a pathway now to move to fifth grade, which was, I think, what we all wanted to see.
It's convoluted, and Dr. Allen, I think, has every process memorized. But the net result is there is a mechanism for every student to not be retained. It might include tutoring during the school year, might include summer school, but there is a pathway for every student to avoid being retained, which wasn't the case last year.
Well, we had some, like Thompson Station Elementary,
yeah,
had like 50% failure rate. And they all, you know, made it through,
yeah,
through counseling or whatever. But some schools in the state was 60, 70, 80%.
Yeah.
And I was wondering how they got past the third grade retention issues. But, I mean, I guess they just work with them.
Yeah, so. And of course, that was the first year that students were taking TCAP. We did add second grade TCAP. This year, just the year we just finished, to prepare students a little better so that they've actually seen the test.
You think that's going to help?
I think it's going to eliminate that variable. And Julie, I know we've had some discussions about that.
It will definitely eliminate the variable, and it will give two sets of teachers information. It's going to give those current third grade teachers information about how their second graders did, tell them where to start, where to go. It's going to give our second grade teachers information of where to spend more time, what to teach differently, what to enhance differently for their current second graders. So there's some student piece there for sure, but there's also a significant amount
of
the
teacher.
But I
think the biggest issue that came up is some of the kids were A and B students.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reading, Ames Webb and everything was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then they'd sit down and take this test.
Mm-hmm.
And they fail it twice,
yeah,
and not only the parents are just outraged, but even the child, they're like,
yeah,
what's going on?
How do I have A's and B's and then fail the test?
Yeah.
That would be
nice. You know, so, I mean, we talked about that in the beginning of the third grade retention, you remember?
That's exactly.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and we've talked about that too, the relationship, especially at the elementary level, between grades and mastery of the standards. One of the things, and you guys have heard me talk about it, focusing on teacher teams working together, taking those common formative assessments that don't show up in your grades to help teachers identify, have these students master the standards I just taught, and if not, restructure your pacing so you can spiral back and make sure those students master it. And you know, everybody's on that continuum, on that journey somewhere. Some of them are, you know, way ahead of others in working that out.
Well, in your case, too, I think that might identify, because, you know, I was a victim of this when I was in school early on, but some kids can't take the test.
Uh-huh.
That's there's a whole skill set there.
There's a whole skill set, uh-huh, so you can identify, if you've got an A-B student that is not doing well on the test, well, maybe that's where you accommodate on the test part of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there was one other thing, because I got three grandsons in third and one in fourth, you know. So I'm hearing all this stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing is the schools, you know, and the teachers are trying to get everybody prepared, and, you know, we got this test coming up, you know, and that. Gotta eat a big breakfast, and
they,
you know,
that song.
They're just prepping for this test. These kids are like,
they feel it. Yeah.
Stressors.
See,
yeah.
And the pressure's on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think you're better off just saying, hey, there's a quiz this week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's truth to that.
Yeah.
My story about that is a parent shared that their son, the first year of this third grade retention, said, I'm not good in oral reading fluency. I don't know that a child needs to be able to describe. Oral reading fluency. Right.
That's
yeah.
Sad.
But he had heard his mother say that because the teacher had told his mother that.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah. Mm.
All right. We're going to flip to testing programs next. Update in State Board of Education policy, where end of course tests, and this is on page 2, are a minimum of 15%. in this particular, where it says weighted TCAP scores, the TCAP in grades 3 through 8, that did not change, but I think our recommendation is to go ahead and change it for all. So that's why you see the 15% for TCAP and end of course.
So Dr. Webb, would you mind speaking to that a little bit about the why of the why we're sticking to 15%?
And at the secondary level, when we think about the weighting of the EOC, the middle school TCAP, and the percentage of an exam grade, we want it to be substantial enough that it's there's equality between whether or not I'm taking an EOC or a TCAP assessment versus the final exam grade. So we're looking for consistency between the two. At the high school level, a student who takes the who's in an EOC course, as an example, that grade counts as their exam grade. It's a substitution, so it makes sense that there's consistency because that's their way from that assessment. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense. All right. The next one is physical assault leave. So, was it last year? Last year, physical assault leave was if a teacher was absent from their assigned duties as a result of a personal injury caused by a physical assault or other violent criminal act completed in the course of the teacher's employment duties. This year, the law changed, and it now includes any staff member, not just teachers. So we have obviously included that, and we have also included, per the new state law, hourly employees and what that would look like compared to the teachers, which are obviously salaried. So all of this is... legal changes. How many did we have last year?
We did not have very many. I don't have an exact number. I can remember one teacher in particular, and then a few more paraprofessionals, probably because they're working with the students and maybe got injured. But we didn't have. We only had one teacher that was out for a significant amount of time.
Was it due to a child having a disability?
It was.
Okay.
Yes. That's where
we've seen that happen. Because it's going to be workers' comp, per the statute, has to kick in first, then this. So it's going to be a lengthy period that the employee is out before this benefit would kick in.
So workers' comp pays 2/3 of the average weekly wage, but this guarantees full pay.
Correct. If they're out 2 days, we'd cover the 2 days with the physical assault leave. Let's say they get injured and their doctor says you need to stay home if they've been hit in the head or something like that for 2 days. Physical assault leave pays them that 2 days.
So they don't have to use their sick.
Right. They don't have to use their own leave.
Okay. The next one is substitute teachers, and that is on page 2. Now there is a state law requirement that substitute teachers receive annual school safety training. So Fletch and his team will be providing that training, video training to substitute teachers. So that will be...
That's good.
Yes.
I think that's like a good that.
Thing. And we've already started that, too. Thank you. I apologize on the sub-training.
We do sub-training. We do brand new subs and start to do the hours training. We've got to add that in to what Fletch wants to do for the annual training. But we have got it set up. We've got a plan.
Is it a specific state standard training that Fletch is teaching, or did Fletch and his team come up with a
better plan?
it's, care plan curriculum that they're using?
So it's, there are requirements per the state law, but Fletch teaches ALEKS.
Which is alert, lockdown, inform, counter, evacuate.
Got it.
Which he's taught all of, I mean, central office, he's trained all of us in this.
Well, what's the other one that's pretty popular right now?
Julie thinks she's got it.
Well, I don't know that I'm going to think of it, but we have some schools who, in collaboration with Fletch, have folks come in and talk about it.
Right.
I feel like it starts with a P now.
And what was that acronym that you used?
Alert, lockdown, inform, counter.
Alice.
A-L-I-C-E. Counter.
What was the guy's name?
Inform and what?
Alert, lockdown, inform, counter, or maybe confront, depending on who you hear that from, and evacuate or escape is sometimes used in that as well.
And obviously we don't need to put that into policy.
Not
because
policy.
We don't want the bad guys to
into,
know what the training is about. Right?
Yeah, right.
I get it.
Just to know that we are compliant with the state law.
The state law may change, but we're still compliant.
It could, right. Absolutely. So zero tolerance. Update on the zero tolerance law this last legislative session. So you may remember last year a new zero tolerance offense was the threat of mass violence, which is on the second page, threat of school-related mass violence. So the piece that has changed is the statute calls it valid. Our terminology, our normed terminology, is credible, just so, but we included both. Threat would be committed, and it's going to be determined whether or not it is a valid or credible threat by the threat assessment team, which that team, Fletch heads. There's law enforcement pieces, there's juvenile court, there's, they are our kind of, when we go through our threat protocol, our first line. That's some of the first people that we are going to call. They're going to do their investigation from a threat assessment, so that we are safe, and then they will be the ones, once the investigation is complete, that determine whether or not it was a valid or credible threat of school-related mass violence. So that is the tweak. Previously, they were still involved in the threat protocol piece, but then it was the schools going back in administration determining that.
So it's a little bit of a step back from last year when the legislature added threats to the zero tolerance law. Now there's an element of what they're calling validity or credibility to the threat. So there might be, you know, we talked about this with Julie, that elementary student who just blurts something out and there's no validity to the threat. They just toss it out. They might not get a zero tolerance like they did this past year under state law.
So it's less black and white. There's more judgment involved.
Yes, exactly.
There is, but I think it's the people who are are truly doing the investigation from our standards of is there a threat. They're the ones doing that assessment on the ground.
So since it's changed, do you think we'll see less petitions filed for this?
I don't know that it'll be less, but I think it will be consistent.
Yeah.
At least that's the plan, is a level of consistency.
And I think that the analysis, when the threat assessment team is doing the analysis, they've been, in essence, part of their determination is, does this threat reach the level of a criminal threat? And if it does, that may drive the discipline more so than the discipline driving whether there's a petition filed, if that makes sense.
Does that make sense?
Are some of these changes due to what happened to the eighth grader at Page Middle?
I don't know about a specific student, but I think it's due to the legislature saying, That we went a little too far.
Yeah, I think they got feedback. As a, I think lots of different legislators got feedback from.
I've got it second or third hand, but I was hearing stories that there were examples across the state.
Yeah.
But I don't really have any particular story to pinpoint that to.
The next one is the opioid antagonist. I don't know why I find that name funny, but I do. I think because I never thought that an opioid could be an antagonist. Anyway, so two pieces of legislation that it has to be stored in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions. I don't think that has ever been an issue with us, but it's in policy now. And then the law change, school district staff, we can't prohibit a student, employee, or visitor from possessing the opioid antagonist while they're on our property or attending a school-sponsored activity held at another property. So that is a difference in how we will handle things.
Does this change anything about who can administer it?
It does not.
No.
Our nursing staff trained before school just like they have. I think it really is the difference of traditionally we have not allowed students or staff to have it on their person if we knew about it, and that will change.
But theoretically, if other people are now allowed to possess it, then they can also administer it.
Mm-hmm. Practically, you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right.
Good Samaritan will kick in.
And we've talked to SROs about this. There's no indication that the number of doses might have a negative impact. So we've known, law enforcement says sometimes we come and give, you know, 2-3 doses, just to make sure.
So the last one for first and final reading is reporting child abuse. Several years ago, legislature created the child abuse coordinator. Just so y'all know, that's every principal in our buildings. And then we also have alternative child abuse coordinators, and those are our APs. Now, the additional requirement is that we have to submit that information to the Department of Children's Services. We're waiting on, we have a list. We're waiting on who we need to send it to, but it's been our principals and assistant principals, and their role is obviously to help anyone as a mandatory reporter, help them report, help them walk through that piece. So that is that change on that role. In that policy. So we've got two policies for first reading. The first one is a new policy. State law requires now that we have a policy on the use of artificial intelligence programs. Behind y'all is Andy Davis. She is head of our instructional technology, and she has been educating all of us on AI. Andy and her staff had a procedure in place, and we had a blurb in our district-wide student handbooks last year about AI for staff and students. And so what we have worked on is a policy. The law does not give a lot of parameters about what all has to be in the policy.
That's what I was going to ask, as usual.
And then Andy has also been working on an SOP, and a lot of the day-to-day procedure on how you get an application approved, those kind of things are going to be in that SOP, so it's ready to roll. The big nuts and bolts, the big idea has not changed from what we did last year, so the blurb in the student handbook is pretty much the same. But Andy is here to answer any...
I'm trying to get it out some quicker.
I think I've already introduced her. I've already... No, she's here to help if there are AI questions. I do think she and her staff have a great plan on how we can incorporate it, but still have our students and staff be safe when using it. And educate them on what's good and bad use of artificial intelligence.
So, Andy, can I give a nutshell first that may or may not be fully accurate and let you fill
Absolutely.
In?
Absolutely, yes, sir.
The basics of what we're talking, what the structure we're putting in place is, number one, there's a lot of artificial intelligence out there, and the reality is it's impossible to totally avoid it. For use in WCS, we are making sure we vet each product through Andy's department to make sure it's appropriate, with really a focus on making sure that the companies can't take data on our students.
That's good. Correct.
Right. So.
Do you want me to add?
Yeah. Add it.
Sure. So we have vetted applications since I've been in this department, this is my 11th year in the department. So we've been vetting applications for a very long time. What we've done is we've added 5 additional questions to our vetting form that we send out to the vendors. The first one is, do their policies state whether the AI is being used, right? So they need to, if they're using it, they need to be transparent about it. Can we opt out? So we've actually already talked to some of our vendors that have just kind of turned it on, and we've actually opted out to make sure that we have a policy in place and guardrails before we start turning on some of these embedded AI. Pieces in some of the products that we already purchase. And then we want to know, like, is their AI, is it proprietary to that particular company, or are they using something in the background like ChatGPT? And then particularly what we're most concerned with is, what do they do with the data? Are they using our data to train the model or the machine? And that's pretty much a hard no for our department. We will not allow them to use that data to go back and train other sources of AI. And then we also want to know how their AI data model is being improved over time. And again, that's that no-no of, like, you can't use our data to train the model on. So one of our vendors actually calls it a walled garden, which is something that we really like to hear, basically, that our data is used within our data pool, so that the machine can learn more, a little bit more, and, you know, provide opportunities for differentiation or different things that can help benefit student learning, but that it doesn't actually go out there to, like, the internet and things like that. So those are the 5 things that we've added to our vetting application, and we've actually reached out to all of our vendors and asked them to start completing that, and we're slowly getting those in, because of course they want to ask their legal attorneys to make sure that what they're saying is accurate.
So what would a program to be utilized in student instruction look like?
So we actually have, I'll give you an example of our new math program. So you've heard a little bit about some of what McGraw-Hill can do, where this is not student or teacher actually using the data. This is actually called machine learning. So what it's doing is it's taking the student's performance, and then it's differentiating assignments based on that type of performance. So that's one type of AI that is currently in use in the district.
So if a student gets a question right, the next question that pops up is a little bit more difficult. If a student misses it, the next question that pops up might be something a little simpler to kind of identify where the student is in the learning. Is that a good description?
That is a good description. McGraw-Hill works a little bit differently than that, but that's pretty accurate. I think it takes, like, the whole assessment pieces of the puzzle, and then basically it will differentiate the assignments where it sees gaps in those standards, because it is standard-based.
So that's an example of how the machine is using that data to improve student learning.
Dan, for example, if you and I sat down and we took a quiz in math using our math program, the questions that you would get wrong would be different than the questions that I would get wrong, and it would tell the teacher, this is what Dan needs to work on, so give Dan these problems. This is what Dave needs to work on, so give Dave these problems. It learns from the responses of the student and then tailors the instruction, helps the teacher be more efficient in tailoring the instruction for the student. That's called machine learning, which this has all been really eye-opening to us, which is different than what you mostly hear about out there, which is your Chat GPT and those things where you can just tell it to write a paper for you. Those are generative AI.
Like, well, that's what I'm asking. Right. It's got to be vetted for one thing. But let's say a teacher just gets really bogged down with something and she's got to have a lesson plan or a paper on George Washington, and she goes into AI and says, I need a paper on George Washington.
Yeah. So that's where this policy is one thing, but then Andy's department vets every one of those programs, and her team, based on what she was just sharing earlier, would either open that up to our faculty or not open that up to our faculty. It's based on how they collect the data, what student data they would capture, what teacher data, all the things that they do behind the scenes with the data. Because it's something that seems really exciting, but we've got to be careful and look to see what actually is happening with the data.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Can this get out of control?
One of my favorite things that Dave says is go slow to go fast. And we've gone really slow with the use or even the adoption of artificial intelligence products because of that. And also, I do want to add that we don't vet in isolation. We partner with information technology who has a stake in it. We partner with our curriculum specialists and TLA who has a stake in it to make sure that we're looking at any product from all different sides, right? Because we want to make sure it's highly rigorous and best for student learning. We also want to make sure that there's data privacy and filtering and it works on our network. So it's a big partnership to get these applications vetted for approval.
Another interesting piece is that, to your example with the history assignment, we actually have Turnitin.com, which in some facets utilizes AI to detect the use of AI in a student essay. So if I write an essay and I turn it in to my teacher, that she can upload it, or actually the student uploads it into Turnitin.com to submit it to the teacher, and it detects the use of AI. So if I just ask ChatGPT to write an essay and I turn it in, this software will actually detect it and tell the teacher that I use a ChatGPT or another artificial intelligence to actually write that essay. So when a teacher is given an assignment, they're clear about what resources are appropriate, what are the appropriate ways to use AI, which in some instances, a grammar coach inside of a software tool like Microsoft Word and other tools, Grammarly, those are actually AI tools. So that teacher, when they identify the scope of an assignment, will say, these are the types of resources that are appropriate, these are the AI tools that are appropriate to use in this assignment, these are the ones that are not. And this is the tool that we're going to use as a class to ensure that when you turn it in that you haven't utilized one of those prohibited resources.
And that's a part of the policy that I really like. It talks about effective use of generative AI and our responsibility to help educate kids on that. Because they have access to it right now at home and they're using it wildly. And they need to know that there's a human element that has to review what is given to them. It can't be considered 100% accurate. When it's considered plagiarism and when it's not considered, how to use it, basically, because they're using it. So there's an obligation, and the policy speaks to it, for us to teach students how to effectively use it.
Have they figured out how to get around it?
Probably.
We got some pretty sharp students.
How many approved AI apps or programs do you think we have right now?
So I don't want to venture a guess because we're still trying to gather some of that data from some of our vendors, but I would say it's a small handful that's actually turned on. So where students or teachers can actually create like a generative type of AI, where they can actually give it a prompt and it creates something unique and new. I can think of maybe two or three right now where we have students even being able to access it. Because we don't have a policy in place, Bill Fulmer from Information Technology has actually been blocking a lot of those pieces, those full generative AI where it's not even embedded in a product. They're actually blocked right now on our network.
But if students use a different device, a non-WCS device.
Absolutely. Right. And our curriculum specialists have done a great job really training teachers how to teach and give assignments in the age of AI, right? So they talk a lot about like having on-demand writing that's very similar to what it would look like, you know, on an AP test or, you know, an EOC test. It really is that on-demand writing. So they've really been doing a great job giving some instructional strategies for our teachers as well.
And you mentioned AP, IB, a lot of those providers are in the process of evaluating this too and making decisions on what they're going to allow. So a lot of this is going to be happening, you know, concurrently with some of those other programs.
Since we're already, we're talking about this and on our systems, our laptops or Chromebooks, whatever, is there, are we going to ever rethink then the back in the old days, the BYOT, your own technology, that maybe kids don't need cell phones in the schools anymore because, or their own computers, because it's so tight now and they have one-on-one laptops, ours, is there a reason to even have technology now?
I'm going to speak generally and then we can get specific. I glanced over at Lee. It's actually fairly rare that we are intentionally having students use their cell phones in class.
Right.
What we've heard from parents whose children have cell phones is we'd like them to have it because we can keep an eye on them, we can contact them, we can track them. But generally speaking, in the schools, their cell phones might be used during cafeteria time before and after school.
Right, but not they don't need it in the classroom.
They don't need it in the classroom. Okay, guys, I don't know that there's any example.
There are a few examples in perhaps an AP class where a student may have downloaded, like so they're taking an AP computer science class and they purchased some additional software and they downloaded onto their computer where it may appropriately, you know, assist them with a project that they're working on, and that's really case by case. Outside of that, really there isn't a need for a student's cell phone in class or for them to bring their own device. You'll see, and I'm hearing it as we visit schools on Friday and are going back tomorrow to visit campuses, we're hearing from teachers and administrators that they're even creating policies within their own classrooms that those phones need to be put in their backpack or hung up in a little shoe pouch at the front of the room just to deter the temptation of utilizing it from, you know, taking a picture of a math problem and using AI inappropriately to solve that problem instead of engaging in the problem themselves.
Would that ever become a policy to say, you know, just like that, rather than a school by school or teacher by teacher, but to have a countywide
potentially
district standard?
Yes, and I will tell you that in what we've been reading, that's likely something that the legislature might pick up too at some point, because there have been some nationwide examples of legislatures having that discussion. So we are trying to get ahead of it a little bit.
Right.
We're in that vetting process.
Right.
But teachers do implement slightly differently from class to class.
I think that's one of the biggest jobs assistant principals have, mm-hmm. is the phone police.
Yeah.
You know, like my kids, I got them in high school too, and they have them in elementary now.
That's right.
On the bus everywhere.
That's right.
But you'd never, if you said we're gonna make a school policy that says no phones, you know, we'd all be voted out of office tomorrow. These parents would go ballistic.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
We can control use during classroom time. But,
right.
But saying you can't bring them, that's going to be a no.
Yep.
The biggest eye-opener for me on AI was in a work setting where someone said, you know, we were all acting like this was a new thing. You know, AI was this new, you know, shiny toy. And he was like pointing out all the ways AI has been used in our other programs we've used at work for 10 years.
Right.
We just didn't know, we didn't call it AI.
It's not
AI.
Yeah.
But it was AI.
That class, that seminar we went to.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's, I remember that one.
And I feel like that's probably happening in the school setting too. Yeah. Like it's been in these programs before, but we just didn't call it that.
Right. Even Google.
Google's an AI.
I mean, it's AI.
Yeah.
I think Andy told me, well, your bank online, your banking online is AI. It's machine driven, but I was like, oh.
Well, try to get a hold of somebody. You're talking to the computer. That's AI,
that's
right?
Right? Yep, that's right.
So the other policy for first reading, thanks, Andy.
Mm-hmm. Andy, if you want to leave.
Credit requirements for graduation. Update on state board regulations. So update on our policy. On page one, the world language, fine arts, those were just moved from the other page. There is an addition, which is the computer science, that is new. And then you'll see in lines 20 through 24, that includes the updated information about math. We're now a fourth higher level math course, may include computer science. Same with lines 25 and 26, computer science could be used for a science credit. Then we have got on the next page, you'll see those additional path requirements. Those were just moved to the front page. Then in beginning in ninth grade, talks about the computer science in high school. They can use it for either math, science, or an elective focus. So one class they can't use for all, but there are options. And if they transfer from another state or country, and it's at, or from a non-public school to a WCS high school, and they're a 12th grader, they are exempt from the computer science requirement. And then on next to last page, which for the last page, high school courses taken in middle school, there is an update changing in line one, grade 70 to 60 to be consistent with our uniform grading model, and to just be clear that instead of both semesters, it's that passing for each semester. So that was a recommendation from Dr. Webb.
Is there a reason, Dave, sorry,
not, oh, sure.
Is there a reason why that's not in blue?
On mine it is.
It may just be the way they were copied.
I think it's the copy.
It just may be. Okay. Yeah, it is in blue. So the 60.
What line is that, Dana?
So on line one, 60 is in blue. And then on line two, both is striped through, but for each is in blue. That's that change. And this one came off my printer, so
you'll have
maybe
the same,
when you,
I'll check
you'll
out.
Have the same issue under the college courses one, two paragraphs down as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's just a strike through. The only thing that changed, I think, was the period. But the strike through is earn a letter grade calculated into their GPA instead of the. It's not a pass-fail.
Let me mention the subtlety of this math change. This is the state board changing. Up until now, they required 4 credits plus taking a math course every year. They have removed that second piece.
Mm-hmm.
And so students are not required to take a math course every year. So we've had a discussion, especially with our middle school students who are taking Algebra 1,
that's what
geometry.
I was thinking of. Mine went through that.
Yeah. So this is what we're projecting. Those highest performing students who are doing that are probably still going to take math courses, mm-hmm. those highest level math courses their junior and senior year. But the middle school principals are aware of it. We have refocused. I got to tell a silly story. We were 8th last year in Algebra 1 and 1st or 2nd in about every other course, and we felt like we got to do better. I'm talking about 8th statewide. And part of what we focused on was making sure that, especially at the middle school level, students were getting the standards they needed in 6th and 7th grade math, and not just advanced to Algebra 1 just because it was something they wanted. That's going to drive us more than this change. But the middle school principals are aware of it, so they're going to have some deeper conversations with their students about where do you want to go with math. Mm-hmm.
Do we have Lee? Any?
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
The only thing I was going to add is that for many of our students, a super high percentage are still college bound, yeah, and taking a year off from mathematics senior year of high school and then going into math in college is not a recommendation. So even though the state has backed off their requirement, a lot of our counseling conversations are going to be, what's next for you? Are you college bound? Have you completed your college math credits that you're going to need for whatever your major is going to be? If that answer is no, the likelihood is that they're going to be recommended to take a math their senior year. Because math is like a language, right? You don't want to take a year off and then continue to pursue it at a university level.
I talked to a student who was being recruited in a sport from a couple of Ivy League schools, and they said, in essence, don't you dare slack off your senior year,
yeah,
because you might not,
yes,
you might not get here.
So in the past, the ninth grade wasn't including their grades, but now it is.
Correct.
Okay. And I was wondering, is there any, and this is kind of a little bit sideways, but when kids start taking algebra in the 8th, 9th grade, and then when it comes to taking the ACT, obviously they've been so out of touch with algebra. That's been a big thing because all of a sudden, you know, the ACT is pretty, you know, algebra heavy.
Yeah.
And so do they do a kind of a, is there a refresher course that they can take?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So all of our high schools work with our college and career readiness lead here at Central Office, and they all have ACT prep things incorporated into the core. So as an example, you're right, I may be in pre-cal, but it's been 7th grade, yeah, since I've had Algebra 1 skills. So we do have an ACT prep integration into the core, especially going into junior year, but we're taking that.
And everyone has to take it. Okay.
It's incorporated into our core instruction.
Okay,
yeah,
terrific.
Those reviews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There is an additional course offered at our high school. Students can take those courses for credit. We offer those in the summer. We have after-school prep courses that they can take as well. But our push is that we have an integration into the reteaching of those skills into our core curriculum so that you're getting a natural review as you progress.
Perfect. Thank you.
Yes.
It's not a big deal, but is there a reason why these last two were not just putting on first-person only greeting? Because they're both state-driven, state-law-driven.
They are, and I welcome if y'all are comfortable putting them there. We weren't sure because it wasn't so, there's more meat to them. But given the feedback, I'm very comfortable with putting it on. I didn't want to suppose that, but I think that'd be a great idea. And then they're done.
I've been talking too much tonight, but it's clearly to me the credit requirements for graduation is compliance. The having a policy in AI is compliance, but what the policy says isn't. But if you all as a group are comfortable taking it to the board just to make sure something's in place,
any recommended changes.
Yeah,
right.
There wasn't, no. And I think
I would recommend we put them all as first reading, first and final.
Yeah. You guys all okay with that?
Yeah.
For all of these?
Uh-huh.
For the last two as well.
Yeah.
Because everything can be tweaked in the future.
If
needed.
Well, and with that
and AI, there's going to be
and a lot of the
more
things
added
that we're going to want to tweak. We have purposely, since this is the first one, broad,
mm-hmm,
with more specifics in the SOP of how we get to approvals.
Right.
So, yeah.
Cool.
Good
works for me.
We can do that.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you. It is an SOP.
Standard operating procedure.